I'm Pete Portanova. It's an honor to be here today to share with you my personal history and my 55 years working as an engineer. In doing so, we will review some history of the Air Force space and missile systems. It's my hope to inspire people to pursue this career because I feel that working in the space and missile environment was exciting. Furthermore, you will soon find out that I had many obstacles along the way. In today's space, environmental technology is constantly evolving and the need for engineers has never been greater. I can personally promise that you will never be bored. I certainly never was. And if I can do it, you can too. My childhood started with three big bangs, a sign of things to come in 1929. Bang number one, in January 1929, my parents, both orphans from Naples, Italy, arrived in New York City with high hopes. Number two, I was born in August of 1929, just outside New York City limits in Mount Vernon. Number three, then the Great Economic Depression was the third big bang when the stock market crashed in October 1929. My family lost everything. Banks closed, homes were lost, everyone was unemployed, and hope was dashed for many years. We had to move several times because we couldn't afford to pay the city rents. After several years, we moved to East White Plains, a.k.a. Silver Lake, New York, about 15 miles north of downtown Manhattan, Little Italy, to a neighborhood of European immigrants. The demographics consisted mostly Italians, some Irish, Afro-Americans, Polish, and Germans. It was a working-class neighborhood. Some were poor and some were very poor. I did not realize that we were poor until I was about 9 or 10 years old and visited the nearby wealthy neighborhoods to look for work. My father had good mechanical skills, but he was very limited in speaking English. As a result, he was only able to get manual labor jobs such as ditch digging. Of course, most of the boys my age, myself included, follow their father's job. I had to help my father pay the family bills, so I had many jobs throughout my early life while continuing to go to school, including ditch digging like my father. I have been working since I was 9 years old. Since we were in the suburbs of White Plains in New York City, there were working opportunities for young boys. In addition, about 3 miles away, there were opportunities to work in and or caddying at the nearby country club, Century and Old Oaks. Caddying provided work at a very early age, at about 9 years old, that required carrying a very heavy golf bag containing 14 clubs, shoes, sweaters, umbrellas, and so forth. This is my earliest recollection of my try and try again. I was skinny and underdeveloped kid, and the caddy master was concerned that I could not carry all the weight. However, I was highly motivated to make money, and I had a can-do attitude. Eventually, the caddy master allowed me to caddy, but not without regular older boys. I usually started later in the day after the other boys had already completed their full day of work of caddying and were going home. If I got to work, I was only given the second round caddying after standing in the hot sun for many hours waiting my turn, usually with no available drinking water. After completing 18 holes of golf, I would leave for home. With no public or transportation available, I would walk and run all the way with my 75 cents to a dollar and a quarter earnings. Many days I did not even earn any money, but I would still not give up. I would return the next day and the next day, until I was finally selected for caddying. I learned perseverance. This because a recurring theme in my life. If you want something, you must be persistent. Do not let anyone tell you you can't do it. If you do not succeed at first try, try again and do not give up. The year 1939 was a very good year because I earned some money. However, this caused me some mixed emotions. Even though I was finally making more money for my family, I loved learning things. School was a huge struggle for me, constantly being put in the back, dumbbell row. I could get no support from my Italian-speaking immigrant family. I remained very curious. I remember feeling that going to school and learning something new was still better than ditch digging. I was highly motivated on the one hand to earn money while I knew the future I wanted a professional job. As a young age, I understood that this meant going to school and getting higher education. Throughout my childhood, I had to juggle the need to make money to help support my family with the long-term goal of getting an education while the hope of getting out of my humble beginnings, if my curiosities were to be satisfied, and in my future was even going to be better. However, World War II broke out and it influenced me in many ways. By the time I entered high school, I was determined to enlist in the military. Just as World War II was in its final phase, I graduated from the 10th grade. The last 2 years of my high school were in a location 5 miles away. This gave me an opportunity to quit high school and try to enlist in the Navy. Unfortunately, I was rejected because I was only 16 years old. I returned to the senior high school, and to my surprise, for the first time I was treated differently from the dumbbell row. I was allowed to take a college preparation course. On the other hand, my previous poor performance in junior high followed me, and I had to work off previous demerits. I managed to do this again, motivated into not let anything or anyone hold me down. I was able to stay in school and work them off. As you can see, I had a somewhat checkered high school experience marked by great changes. My continued interest in learning began to pay off. This ended abruptly when my military enlistment was put on hold until 1947. After serving on it as a radarman aboard a destroyer, I was honorably discharged from the military in August of 1951. Only a few weeks after leaving the military, I entered the State University of New York. I was the first in my family to attend college. I graduated from Georgia Institute of Technology in 1957, but now had a wife, a new baby, and an engineering degree. March of 1957, I accepted a job as a guided missile engineer at Douglas Aircraft Company in Santa Monica. In late 1930s, my curiosity demanded that I learn more about radios. Specifically, I was very curious how a radio was able to produce sound. I was constantly on the lookout for an explanation. Since I was unable to get an explanation, I developed my own theory, continued to study and learn more science. I thought if I could learn to operate and repair a radio, then I could get a good paying job, which I knew had to be better than ditch digging. Then my uncle paid for me to visit the 1939 New York World's Fair, and my interest exploded. There I saw an exhibit of the radio and television. This was a very exciting experience. I wanted to understand television and radio fundamentals. How did they work? My drive to learn was unrelenting. During World War II, my interest in science expanded from just curiosity for the radio to include transmitting of Morse code and aeroplanes. Watching a movie newsreel, I saw the Morse code being used and the excitement of the fighter pilots. As luck would have it, the Army Air Corps had a base only 4 miles away. The Army asked all the high school students to make precise, to-scale, miniature aeroplanes out of balsam wood to help teach trainees how to identify the different aircraft in their identification training program. This caused a fascination with planes and created fantasies to me to become a fighter pilot. My science curiosity shifted toward wanting to understand how aeroplanes flew. At the time, I became overwhelmed and obsessed with quitting school and becoming a fighter pilot and fighting for my country. Despite this, and because I was too young, I was never able to enlist before the war ended. I graduated from high school and immediately enlisted in the Navy. I was part of the occupation forces aboard a naval destroyer for 4 years. I was fortunate in attending the Navy Radar Fundamental Electronics School, followed by shipboard hands-on experience for very small rockets. After discharge from the Navy in August 1951, I was already a bit older than the typical college student and felt being in a hurry to get my education. Using the GI Bill, I chose to start a 21-month continuous electrical curriculum at the University of New York, White Plains. After completing this, I went to Georgia Institute of Technology, graduating with an engineering degree in March of 1957. During my college education, I learned about German V1, V2 technology and was introduced to the work of Professor Robert H. Goddard, the American rocket pioneer who conducted research in the 1920s and 30s. This education became very valuable later in my career, both as Douglas Aircraft Company and Space Technology Laboratory, as I was asked to work on the projects of Thor IRBM, Intermediate Range Ballistic Missile, and the Atlas D, Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, ICBM, which had the heritage from the German V1 and V2 rocketry technology. While at Georgia Tech, the Western Development Division was transferred from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to an empty basement of St. John's Church in Inglewood, California. Under the leadership of Major General Schriever and Dr. Simon Ramo, RWSTL Corporation, starting the development of the Thor Intermediate Range Ballistic Missile, Atlas Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, and Titan ICBMs. Since I was a graduating senior, I was aware of the engineering challenges required to develop these missiles, and upon graduation from Georgia Tech, I was offered a job at Douglas Aircraft Company in Santa Monica as a guided missile engineer. This was a time of urgency due to the Cold War between the United States and Soviet Union, where we believed that the ultimate Soviet Union objective was a communist world. One response to this growing threat of attack by Soviet Union was U.S. Air Force deployment of the Thor IRBM weapon system placed in England. One response to this growing threat of attack by Soviet Union was the U.S. Air Force deployment of the Thor IRBM, which was called Project Emily. The program placed in England allowed for the Thor IRBMs to be the first line of defense, as their operational range of effectiveness was only approximately 1,500 miles. This was vital because it brought time to get the more advanced system of the Atlas ICBMs to become operational, and which had a 5,000-mile range of effectiveness and could be launched from the United States. Thus, the Thor IRBM filled the gap to protect our country from vulnerability. It was a bold strategic deterrence, used until the ICBMs were fully operational. Working on this project gave me career experience that opened doors for me for the rest of my career. This was an exciting, pressure-filled time in the world and in my life. Douglas Aircraft Company was directed in 1955 to be operational within 3 years. Most of the engineers were young, had no experience, but all shared a can-do, must-do attitude. Mistakes were made, but it was taken as part of learning, this never as a reason for abandoning our task. In the process, I was promoted to senior operations engineer, chief test conductor responsible for Project Emily launch complex consisting of 3 missile launch pads. This was an awesome, daunting task for a young engineer with little experience. Soon after Atlas ICBMs became operational, the Thor IRBMs became unnecessary. As a side note, in 1963, the Thor IRBMs were returned to the United States and configured as the workhorse for Delta II space launch systems. Having completed the task, I returned from England to Douglas Aircraft Company in Santa Monica. TRWSTL hired me to be a member of the operation research team to conduct an analytical classified study to measure the effectiveness of the operational LSD ICBM missions. After 15 months, I transitioned to the Aerospace Corporation and was assigned to the Titan III Integrated Transfer Launch System. This was another early important example of engineering technology evolving from the military effort to a launch space program application and a turning point in my career. While working on the Titan III interface, I interfaced with both launch site at Vandenberg Air Force Base and Cape Canaveral Air Force Station personnel. The Titan III ITL was a space launch system that was an innovative and revolutionary in its approach to allowing schedule flexibility of processing launch vehicles and satellites efficiently. From 1974 to 1983, I was assigned to the study team that led to the initial integration and activation at Vandenberg of the Space Shuttle Transportation System, STS, support of the launch and landing site. My responsibility was advanced studies, assisted the Air Force for contractor selection, and support many design reviews. My management responsibility was to interface mostly through working groups, Air Force, and NASA personnel. The shuttle at Vandenberg replicated functionally all of the Kennedy station sets, such as runway, orbiter maintenance and checkout facilities, launch control center, external tank fire processing, and storage facility, launch pad, which would be Slick 6 at Vandenberg, payload preparation room, among other support facilities. The original planning included STS flights from both Kennedy and Vandenberg. The process came to a stop when the shuttle calendar had a flight disaster at Kennedy on 28 January 1986. An investigation of the disaster was initiated, and later, due to lack of funding, the STS program at Vandenberg was canceled. During the mid-1980s, I became an advocate for access to space with affordability. This was not a popular viewpoint. At the time, my career had grown up using the heritage missile systems, Delta, Atlas, and Titan missiles, but it was becoming obvious that these systems were too expensive. This caused a lot of mixed emotions for me. However, with foreign countries making cost-effective missiles, I became a strong advocate of the new affordable launch vehicle system. I was a member of many advanced studies to address this issue. Year after year, they were canceled. Yet, I persevered in this belief for a new affordable launch vehicle system. My greatest honor in my career occurred in 1991 when I was assigned to the Department of Defense Office of the Undersecretary of Defense Acquisition and Technology. I was responsible for the development of a 10-year plan of space launch technology, which was to address a need for lower cost access to space. The previous systems of Delta, Atlas, and Titan were all deemed too expensive. November 1992, the plan was published and provided a framework for coordination of the national investment in space launch technology. The plan included identification of priority technology developments. It was jointly prepared by NASA, Department of Energy, and DOD as a strategy for the National Space Council to shape the future of our national space launch technology programs. While working on this, I encountered many skeptics, naysayers, and felt the constant pull between those who did not want change and the few that advocated a new affordable system. Later, as a technical member of the Mormon study, we were finally able to get a consensus that led to the development of future launch vehicle systems options. One option was the Evolved Expendable Launch Vehicle, EELV, which was ultimately selected. This part of my career required perseverance, patience, and a conviction in my basic belief launch vehicle systems previously successful needed change. During the 1980s and 1990s, the space community had no defined consensus. Despite many attempts to obtain a national consensus and define the direction of the U.S. space launching system, none manifested. At the same time, the international community was continuing to be successfully develop their launch capabilities, which were far more competitive than the Delta, Atlas, and Titan launch systems. The U.S. space community was faced with difficult set of circumstances. In December 1993, The Undersecretary of Defense, Dr. John M. Dorsch, directed the then Lieutenant General Thomas S. Moore, Jr., Vice Commander of Air Force Space Command, to produce the Space Launch Modernization Plan, SLMP, a.k.a. Mormon Study. Although I was a member of the technical section, I was made short presentations on infrastructure and technical and management areas. At the conclusion of this study, it focused on the aging infrastructure and inefficiencies that were making the U.S. launch industry expensive. The study suggested the solution of the U.S. Air Force EELV systems as a means to achieve affordable access to space. The SLMP provided a range of options to reducing the cost while improve operational effectiveness of the U.S. launch system. This led to the birth of EELV. Authorized initially with only a small group of 54 government and 6 aerospace and personnel and a tight budget, had to be innovative and generate a new EELV management techniques. The EELV guide adopted was affordable through innovation. The new challenge was to develop a system capable of launching all configurations from a standard functional launch pad. The contractors were given a set of requirements and were told that everything else was tradable. The stated goal was to develop best launch vehicle system. Contractors were given flexibility and incentives. The focus in the space industry had shifted. Secretary of Defense Perry issued a new policy, quote, a new way of doing business, close quote. It was a period of time that required embracing different approaches and avoiding major design problems inherent in the legacy hardware. Anticipating a high launch rate after new technology for missiles allowed production affordable, a clean pad concept was one result from the advanced studies. The clean pad design consisted of no fixed or moving structures at the launch pad and transferring the launch vehicle to the launch pad only when the launch vehicle could be launched within 24 hours. The launch pad was not meant to be the end of the factory process. My childhood and career mirrored each other in some ways. I learned as a child to dream and imagine outside my neighborhood, even into space. Using my military and college education as a springboard, I continued to dream and explore scientific questions my whole life. Some questions were easier to find answers to than others. Some had more difficult solutions and were unpopular. Many times I dealt with skeptics and sometimes complete rejection, but try and try again was always my motto. I did not just say I lived it, because quite frankly, I had to. Do not let anyone grind you down. Success really happens the first time. Accept rejection, try again. Like a skinny kid in the New York summer sun, stand in the sun if you have to get the job done. Persevere if you want a job. Don't go home, stay. Believe in yourself is key. There will be times when no one else will.